chase a song. Even in the two anti, young man, your murder, think civilized. You thought the summon of a sudden.
Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is Damon Azali Rojas, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're shuffling around guests. We're going to actually have Ajamu Baraka on next week to talk about post-Katrina stuff in relation to internally displaced people. But on the line right now, I have Barbara Bicknell. Barbara.
Welcome. Hello, how are you?
I'm very, very excited to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much for that.
So Barbara, for folks don't know, Barbara's the person who I voted for governor.
I really like you.
There we go. So, Barbara, I mean, I think I've learned more about you in the just by reading the epilogue that you have to the book that is being reprinted, which is called Blue Rage, Black Redemption by Stanley Tookie Williams. So one of the things I know in the book that you were saying, the promise that you made to Stanley was to keep his words out there, to keep teaching people with it.
That's
what you're going to be doing.
And that is what I'm doing. This is Blue Rage, Black Redemption is his memoir. And it's an extraordinary book, and it's told remarkably well. And we've gotten these great reviews. The Kirkus Reviews described it really as a modern day classic. I know the review by heart.
Right.
It says a modern, inspiring companion to Claude Brown's Man-Child in the Promised Land and Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice. That's pretty amazing. And I was with Stan the last day of his life, and I was also went into the death chamber.
And which you describe this in the epilogue of the book.
I do.
And actually, that was
a very hard thing to write. You have to know.
Oh, I'm sure in it. I felt it as I was reading it. And actually, I know, let's first do it a couple of times, so I know you're having a book event, and then I want to see if you can read a little bit from it. And so the book event is going to be on Wednesday, November 14th.
Yes.
Hollywood United Methodist Church from 7:30 to 9.
That's correct.
And the address that is 6817 Franklin Avenue, and 7:30 to 9, and you're going to be talking about the book.
Yes, and Mike Farrell, the actor and activist,
Death Penalty
will be
Focus,
there.
Yeah.
And Tom Hayden will be there with me, and also a gentleman named Melvin Hardy, who is a former Crip and who was one of Stan's really good friends and was there in the beginning of the Crips. He now lives in the Bay Area and is an executive for the Target Corporation, but he remained Stan's friends for all of these decades, and he's going to join us.
Okay. So, Barbara, I sent you a message about a passage that I was hoping that you read from the epilogue.
And I got that message.
Great.
So I'm ready to read it.
So this is just kind of talking a little bit, just for the listeners, is a little bit about just the conditions, the I think very inhumane conditions that Stan was forced to, both he and as well as his visitors were forced to endure. And so go for it.
Okay. It begins. On the fifth day before Stan's scheduled execution, the rules changed once again. This time, Stan and his visitors were moved to a large enclosed room. There was now privacy from strangers, but no privacy from prison guards. From that day forward, an officer was in the room with us throughout our visits because this change in protocol had relegated Stan to a new status. He was now a pre-execution watch prisoner, which meant he could no longer experience even 1 minute alone. The assumption by prison authorities was that Stan, like any prisoner soon to be executed, had to be watched 24 hours a day to stop him from committing suicide. The state of California wanted to be the entity responsible for killing him. If Stan managed to take his own life, That would be an unacceptable outcome. As a pre-execution watch prisoner, he was also required to be manacled in the most inhumane ways. A chain was wrapped around his wrist, his waist, and handcuffs placed on each wrist. Then those handcuffs were connected to the right and left sides of the chain so that he was positioned in a penguin-like stance with his elbows forced to bend. Shackles were placed on his ankles, causing him to walk without being able to raise a foot. He had to shuffle along, dragging his feet to keep from falling. Still, he stood as upright as possible, given the conditions, as he entered the new visiting room. In the middle of this room was a steel chair that had been bolted to the floor. Stan was instructed to sit there. He was then chained to the chair, like Hannibal Lecter, so he could barely move in any direction throughout our visits. Moreover, it took so much time to get unchained from that chair to use the bathroom, Stan would forego eating and drinking for 8 hours or more so that he did not have to urinate and thus did not have to leave his visitors and lose precious moments with them.
So you guys are listening to Barbara Bicknell, who this is her epilogue in Blue Rage, Black Redemption, which is Stan Suki Williams' book, which is about to be re-released on the 13th. I was awestruck when I was listening, when I was reading what your epilogue. And I think you kind of understand what the state is trying to do in terms of basically using him as an example. For people who weren't there, for people who don't know Tookie Stanley, what would you want them to know about? What did you learn in that moment when you were watching how they were treating him?
Okay, I learned at least two things. I learned that the actual execution, where he was in fact tortured to death for 35 long, long minutes. But what I learned was, the torture and the inhumanity began before he walked into the death chamber, that the way the rules changed at San Quentin, he was stripped of all of his clothes except his underwear in those last few days. He had to take everything, the sheets off the cot in the cell, his toothbrush, everything. His TV was put outside of the cell to brush his teeth. He had to ask a guard to give him his toothbrush. He could brush his teeth and then had to give it right back. He had to get his bed clothing just when it was time to go to sleep, and then he had to give it back when he woke up in the morning. If he wanted the television cut on or the channel change, he had to have them do it. So what I'm saying is, it was a process of, it's not enough that we are planning to kill you, but we are going to attempt to strip you of any shred of dignity, humanity that you have left, of self-respect. The goal is to strip you of that, so that we kill you, we kill your body, and we kill your spirit and your soul. And so it was just absolutely the worst, most horrific experience of my entire life. Now, that's what the system is set up to do. But Stanley Tookie Williams, at the same time, it was the most remarkable experience of my life, because he demonstrated unbelievable courage. He did not allow them to break his spirit. And at one point, I was so upset over the inhumanity of the preparation of toward the march toward the execution. And he said to me, chained down, and I talk about this in the epilogue, he turned to me and he said, do not allow these people to break you. He says, you represent me. And these people are trying to kill me, and I will not allow them to break me. You do not allow them to break you. And I'll tell you, to this day, it's what I hold on to, that it has put the steel in my spine to continue this work, to keep my commitment to him, to keep his work out there, to keep his legacy advancing, and to fight the death penalty and to fight the corrupt criminal justice system, because I remember he didn't break. He demonstrated extraordinary courage, and I will do the same.
Yeah, I was looking through the book, and I was trying to find the actual piece where the last few moments where you saw him before they took him away, and how you described him as when they were about to unchain him from the floor, from the seat in the floor, and you guys were walking out, that he just stood up and how the chains just rattled. And
you know what? I just found it. You want me to read it?
Please read that.
Okay. At 6 p.m., prison guards rushed us out of the large visiting room with the steel chair for the last time. The thick chain connecting Stan to that chair was removed before we could get out of the room. Though still shackled at the ankles and handcuffed to the manacle around his waist, Stan immediately stood up, causing the chains that engulfed him to rattle noisily. As he rose from the chair, his huge muscled chest expanded to its full width, and Stan's head tilted slightly upward. I remember walking backward out of the room, trying to take in this powerful, upright image of Stan for as long as I could, knowing that the next time I saw him, he would be in a prone position on a gurney, waiting to be killed.
Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah. What I can say is, the experience was the most horrific experience of my life, and it was also the most remarkable experience of my life, because I watched a human being's sort of spiritual transcendence and magnificent courage in the face of horror, of torture, of what we now know was excruciating pain. He truly was, it's not hyperbole or not exaggeration on my part, he was truly tortured to death. The barbiturate that they gave him was not enough to keep him asleep. The other two chemicals, the paralytic agent and the drug that provoked the massive heart attack, was not enough to kill him instantly, and not even in a few minutes. It went on for quite some time, and a federal judge in San Jose held hearings 9 months after the execution, and one of the pharmacological experts said that the drug that they use, the California uses in the lethal, for the lethal injection procedure or protocol, for the average person, they wake up within 2.5 to 3.5 minutes after being injected with the drug, and they then can feel what is happening to them, which is extraordinary pain. And it took him 10 long minutes from the time they administered the barbiturate, which he said for the average person would, that person would start to wake up within 2.5 to 3.5 minutes. And Stan wasn't even the average person, because he was 250 pounds of muscle. And we also learned that the guard who was in charge of the drugs, they later discovered, was smuggling drugs illegally into the prison and that some of the barbiturate was missing. So it's not even clear that he got the dosage he was supposed to get. So it's just...
And also I was reading that the actual procedure wasn't even followed because they're supposed to have it a backup in the other arm in case the actual drugs don't work.
That is exactly right.
And that wasn't followed.
That was not followed. The nurse who was responsible for putting a catheter in or a tube in each arm only put it in one arm, and it took her 20 minutes to do that. We later learned that she had collapsed two of his veins in the process of doing that. So she just walked out and said, you know what, the heck with it. And the other members of the, quote, execution team, close quote, pointed this out to the warden that he didn't have the tube that would allow for backup drugs to help him if he got into trouble, that wasn't connected. And the warden just said, execution proceeds. And in fact, he definitely got into major trouble. His body started contorting and distorting. I'm telling you, it's something that I will clearly live with for the rest of my life, what I saw. And the only thing that I can say is that it inspires me to fight for the rest of my life to do my best and make my contribution, no matter how small, to try to stop this and to try to stop this from happening to anyone else in this country.
I see that every picture that I see, you have a fist up.
So that's exactly right.
Yeah, you were on the Sentinel. I saw you on the website. I think you know, that's just really important. I think it's very, the politicization process, the things that make you really go, oh my, I see now. It's so many disparate things, but I think when you see it as raw as you saw it, that's something that, you know, that is just gonna, it's kind of this contagious. And I think through the writing, in your writing in the book, along with Stan Tookie Williams' words, is very, very contagious. So I think all this points to something happened after the state killed him that the state didn't even expect, right? You were talking about the moratorium, not only in California, but from what I understand, this is actually a moratorium that other states have now put moratoriums on the death penalty. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. What, you know, on the one hand, the state of California clearly felt that they had really sort of succeeded and won a big one in killing Stanley Tookie Williams. But I'll tell you, it was an awful price to pay, that what they did to him in torturing him to death. But it was because he was such a high-profile death row prisoner, and the fact that they did torture him to death, and that a federal judge asked to see the heart monitoring records of Stan during his execution. He also looked at about the last five or six people who were executed, but he talked in his brief mostly about Stan and what happened to Stan and what they did to him. And the bottom line is, if you really track that it was Stan's execution and the botching of his execution that caused the federal judge to look, and then that cause led to the stopping of the execution of Michael Morales, and then that led to an almost two-year de facto moratorium on the death penalty in the state of California, and then that led to other states jumping on the bandwagon, and then that led to the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago saying they're going to take on this issue, and then that led to them not allowing a man in Mississippi last week to be executed. So now, front page of the New York Times, U.S. Supreme Court has essentially created a de facto moratorium on executions for the entire country. And so if you just move backwards, I took you forward, but if you go backwards, it started with the botching of the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams and him being so high profile that it caused a federal judge to look at it, and now the whole system is unraveling. So from my point of view,
he did it on purpose.
Well, no, I won't say that because it was
I'm not talking about the botching, clearly not that, but I'm talking about in terms of his kind of, he's still working on this.
Well, you know what? Here's how I would put it. I agree with you. It was a spiritual sacrifice. You know, he sacrificed himself and for the greater good. And even while he was still alive, he really was not hot on fighting for clemency, because what he said was, clemency, even if I get clemency, that only saves me, one man. And this has to stop for all men and women on death row. Mm-hmm. So he was not real hot on even the fight for clemency. He wanted us to fight to end the death penalty for everyone. So you know what? I agree with you. He was a powerful person with a powerful spirit when he was alive, and he's a powerful person in the spirit world, I believe. And you're right, he's still working on it and doing a pretty darn good job, I'd say.
I would say so. I'm going to sign him up for the Bus Riders Union.
Very good.
So I wanted to read a little bit of him, of what he wrote, but I think that people are going to have to buy the book because I want to make sure that folks come out to this event. So,
well, let me also say a couple of things. One, please come to the event. It's Wednesday, November the 14th at the Hollywood United Methodist Church at 6817 Franklin Avenue in Hollywood. It's on the corner of Highland Avenue and Franklin. It starts at 7:30 p.m. But here's the other thing. Anyone who's listening, grab a pencil and write this down. Go to www.stwlegacy, so that's short for Stanley Tookie Williams Legacy, stwlegacy.net, and order a book. We have a pre-order campaign, and we have a link to Amazon.com on that site. And what's exciting is our pre-order campaign has already, and our goal is to make it onto the New York Times bestseller list within the next couple of weeks. But we just found out today that Amazon.com has a most popular pre-order book list for biographies and memoirs, and they only track the first 25 or the most popular 25 books that are being reordered or that are being pre-ordered, and we just made it onto that list today. So
there
we are number 24, and I would like us to become number one on that list within a week. That's what I'd like, and then see if we can end up on the New York Times bestseller list.
And what would that do?
Well, if he ends up on his, now I'm not even going to say if, when his book ends up on the New York Times bestseller list, that will make make international front page news, at which point it allows us to discuss our issues once again. What happened, what's going on with lethal injection, the immorality of the death penalty, the racist and corrupt criminal justice system in this country, and all of the things that need to be changed. So it will give us the opportunity to keep our issues front and center in the public awareness. So that's the reason, and that's a pretty important reason, I think.
Right. So I think just the last little bit, and I want to get back, I want to put the website back up again, but I just want to read a couple words from him.
Okay.
And this is Stanley Tookie Williams in terms of the actual book. It's called Blue Rage, Black Redemption, and here it goes. Though the black images we saw across the barricades were seen as the enemy, we had no notion that our true adversaries were the squalid living conditions, the vortex of powers confining us to those conditions, and our own unwitting perpetration of those conditions. Like countless other black gang members and criminals, we were unconsciously accomplices in our own subjugation, our own worst foes. So I think that is really poignant, because I think that when people understand that this is a plan.
Absolutely.
That this is part of, you know, when we talk about the whole death penalty, we talk about the 2.3 million people in prison, the 7.1 million on probation, parole in prison, the fact that it's mostly, you know, overwhelmingly black, the fact that, you know, bills are going through federal government now to put more cops in the street. It's all connected.
Nearly 4,000 are on death row in California alone. 667 men and women are on death row. By the way, California has the largest death row in the United States.
And soon to be I think it might be now 172,000 prisoners, and they just voted to do 53,000 more
exactly.
Cells.
$7.4 billion. On
right.
top of the over $10 billion that is allotted or allocated to the California Department of Corrections, and then I add, and so-called rehabilitation, because it doesn't offer much of that, for sure.
So I encourage folks again, Wednesday, November 14th, Hollywood United Methodist Church, 7:30 to 9, Barbara Bicknell, Mike Farrell, Tom Hayden, Melvin Hardy, going to be talking about Blue Rage, Black Redemption. Pre-order the book. You can go to www.stwlegacy.net. Barbara, thank you so much for being on with us.
And thank you so much for having me on.
All right.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Keep in touch.
All right. Will do.
So thanks, listeners, for listening to Voices from the Frontlines today. Today, I was your host, Damon Osley Rojas, and we'd like to thank our guest, Jason Zinberg, and Barbara Bicknell. Today we heard music from Jeru, Michelle, and Diego Cello, and this is The Sequence. You can listen to previous shows at www.thestrategycenter.org. And we'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, production assistants Lisa Adler, Dehan Song, our engineer, D'Angelo Jones, and we'll be next week with you at the Voices from the Front Lines. Manuel Criollo will be here. And up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. See you later. Don't care like a junior rock, then a friend of staff, my main.